we are. On Randall, when they want you in irons, they put you in irons. You'll bring us to ruin, Martin said. Yourself, me, and Ethel, and all who helped you up and down the line. She wasn't being fair, but didn't much care, feeling mulish. Martin gave her a copy of that day's newspaper and pulled the hatch into place. Any noise from Fiona sent her stock still. She could only imagine what the Irish girl looked like. Occasionally, Fiona dragged junk up to the attic. The stairs complained loudly at the slightest pressure, an efficient alarm. Once the maid moved on, Cora returned to her tiny range of activities. The girl's vulgarities reminded Cora of the plantation and the stream of oaths delivered by the hands when master's eye was not on them. The small rebellion of servants everywhere. She assumed Fiona spat in the soup. The maid's route home did not include a cut across the park. Cora never saw her face, even as she became a student of the girl's size. Cora pictured her, scrappy and determined, a survivor of famine and the hard relocation. Martin told her she'd come to America on a Carolina charter with her mother and brother. The mother got lung sickness and died a day out from land. The boy was too young to work and had a puny constitution overall. Older Irish ladies passed him around most days. Was Irish Town similar to the colored streets in South Carolina? Crossing a single street transformed the way people talked, determined the size and condition of the homes, the dimension and character of the dreams. In a few months, it would be the harvest. Outside the town, in the fields, the cotton would pop into bowls and travel into sacks, picked this time by white hands. Did it bother the Irish and Germans to do nigger work? Or did the surety of wages erase dishonor? Penniless whites took over the rows from penniless blacks, except at the end of the week, the whites were no longer penniless. Unlike their darker brethren, they could pay off their contracts with their salaries and start a new chapter. Jockey used to talk on Randall about how the slavers needed to roam deeper and deeper into Africa to find the next bunch of slaves, kidnapping tribe after tribe to feed the cotton, making the plantations into a mix of tongues and clans. Cora figured that a new wave of immigrants would replace the Irish, fleeing a different but no less abject country, the process starting anew. The engine huffed and groaned and kept running. They had merely switched the fuel that moved the pistons. The sloping walls of her prison were a canvas for her morbid inquiries, particularly between sundown and Martin's late-night visit. When Caesar had approached her, she envisioned two outcomes: a contented, hard-won life in a northern city, or death. Terence would not be content to merely discipline her for running away. He would make her life an ornate hell until he got bored, then have her dispatched in a gory exhibition. Her northern fantasy, those first weeks in the attic, was a mere sketch. Glimpses of children in a bright kitchen, always a boy and a girl, and a husband in the next room, unseen but loving. As the days stretched, other rooms sprouted off the kitchen, a parlor with simple but tasteful furniture, things she had seen in the white shops of South Carolina, a bedroom, then a bed covered in white sheets that shone in the sun, her children rolling on it with her, the husband's body half visible at the edges. In another scene, years hence, Cora walked down a busy street in her city and came across her mother, begging in the gutter, a broken old woman bent into the sum of her mistakes. Mabel looked up, but did not recognize her daughter. Cora kicked her beggar's cup. The few coins flew into the hubbub, and she continued on her afternoon errand to fetch flour for her son's birthday cake. In this place to come, Caesar occasionally came for supper, and they laughed ruefully about Randall and the travails of their escape, their eventual freedom. Caesar told the children how he got the small scar over his eyebrow, dragging a finger across it. He was caught by a slave catcher in North Carolina, but got free. Cora rarely thought of the boy she had killed. She did not need to defend her actions in the woods that night. No one had the right to call her to account. Terrence Randall provided a model for a mind that could conceive of North Carolina's new system, but the scale of the violence was hard to settle in her head. Fear drove these people, even more than cotton money. The shadow of the black hand that will return what has been given. It occurred to her one night that she was one of the vengeful monsters they were scared of. She had killed a white boy. She might kill one of them next. And because of that fear, they erected a new scaffolding of oppression on the cruel foundation laid hundreds of years before. That was Sea Island cotton the slaver had ordered for his rose, but scattered among the seeds were those of violence and death, and that crop grew fast. The whites were right to be afraid. One day, the system would collapse in blood. An insurrection of one. She smiled for a moment before the facts of her latest cell reasserted themselves, scrabbling in the walls like a rat. Whether in the fields or underground or in an attic room, America remained her warden. It was a week before the summer solstice. Martin stuffed one of the old quilts into a chair without a seat and sank into it by degrees over the course of his visit. As was her habit, Cora asked for help with words. This time they came from the Bible, through which she made desultory progress. Gainsay, ravening, whore. Martin admitted he didn't know the meanings of gainsay and ravening. Then, as if to prepare for the new season, Martin reviewed the series of bad omens. The first had occurred the previous week, when Cora knocked over the chamber pot. She'd been in the nook for 4 months and made noise before, knocking her head against the roof or her knee against a rafter. Fiona had never reacted. This time, the girl was puttering around in the kitchen when Cora kicked the pot against the wall. Once Fiona came upstairs, she wouldn't be able to overlook the dripping sound of the mess leaking between the boards into the attic, or the smell. The noon whistle had just sounded. Ethel was out. Fortunately, another girl from Irish Town visited after lunch, and the two gossiped in the parlor for so long that afterward Fiona had to speed through her chores. She either didn't notice the odor or pretended not to, shirking the responsibility for cleaning after whatever rodent's nest was up there. When Martin came that night and they cleaned, he told Cora it was best if he didn't mention the close call to Ethel. Her nerves were especially brittle with the rise in the humidity. Informing Ethel was up to Martin. Cora hadn't seen the woman since the night of her arrival. As far as she could tell, her host didn't speak of her, even when Fiona was off the premises, beyond infrequent mentions of that creature. The slam of the bedroom door often preceded Martin's upstairs visit. The only thing that kept Ethel from turning her in, Cora decided, was complicity.
"Ethel is a simple woman," Martin said, sinking in the chair. "She couldn't foresee these troubles when I asked for her hand."
Cora knew that Martin was about to recount his accidental recruitment, which meant extra time outside the nook. She stretched her arms and encouraged him.
"How could you, Martin?"
"Lord, how could I?" Martin said. He was a most unlikely instrument of abolition. In Martin's recollection, his father, Donald, had never expressed an opinion about the peculiar institution, although their family was rare in their circle in not owning slaves. When Martin was little, the stock boy at the feed store was a wizened, stooped man named Jericho, freed many years previously. To his mother's dismay, Jericho came over every Thanksgiving bearing a tin of turnip mash. Donald grunted in disapproval or shook his head at newspaper items about the latest slave incident, but it wasn't clear if he judged the brutality of the master or the intransigence of the slave. At 18, Martin left North Carolina and, after a period of lonesome meandering, took a position as a clerk in a Norfolk shipping office. The quiet work and sea air suited him. He developed a fondness for oysters, and his constitution improved generally. Ethel's face appeared one day in a crowd, luminous. The Delaneys had old ties to the region, pruning the family tree into a lopsided site, abundant and many-cousined in the north, sparse and faceless in the south. Martin rarely visited his father. When Donald fell while fixing the roof, Martin hadn't been home in 5 years. The men had never communicated easily. Before Martin's mother passed, it was her lot to translate the ellipses and muttered asides that constituted conversation between father and son. At Donald's deathbed, there was no interpreter. He made Martin promise to finish his work, and the son assumed the old man meant him to take over the feed store. That was the first misunderstanding. The second was taking the map he discovered in his father's papers for directions to a cache of gold. In his life, Donald wrapped himself in a kind of quiet that, depending on the observer, signaled imbecility or a reservoir of mystery. It would be just like his father, Martin thought, to comport himself like a pauper while hiding a fortune. The treasure, of course, was the Underground Railroad. Some might call freedom the dearest currency of all, but it was not what Martin expected. Donald's diary, set on a barrel on the station platform and surrounded by colored stones in a kind of shrine, described how his father had always been disgusted by his country's treatment of the Ethiopian tribe. Chattel slavery was an affront to God, and slavers an aspect of Satan. Donald had provided aid to slaves his whole life, whenever possible and with whatever means at hand, ever since he was a small boy and misdirected some bounty men who badgered him over a runaway. His many work trips during Martin's childhood were, in fact, abolitionist missions. Midnight meetings, riverbank chicanery, intrigue at the crossroads. It was ironic that given his communication difficulties, Donald functioned as a human telegraph, relaying messages up and down the coast. The UGRR, as he referred to it in his notes, operated no spurs or stops in North Carolina until Donald made it his mission. Working this far south was suicide, everyone said. He added the nook to the attic nonetheless, and if the false ceiling was not without seams, it kept his charges aloft. By the time a loose shingle undid him, Donald had conveyed a dozen souls to the Free States. Martin helped a considerably smaller number. Both he and Cora decided his skittish personality had not helped them during the close call the previous night, when, in another bad omen, the regulators knocked on the front door. It had been just after dark, and the park was full of those afraid to go home. Cora wondered what waited for them that they lingered so purposefully. The same people week after week. The fast-walking man who sat on the fountain's rim, dragging his fingers through his wispy hair. The slovenly, wide-hipped lady who always wore a black bonnet and muttered to herself. They weren't here to drink the night air or sneak a kiss. These people slumped on their distracted circuits, looking this way and that, never in front, as if to avoid the eyes of all the ghosts, the dead ones who had built their town. Colored labor had erected every house on the park, laid the stones in the fountain and the paving of the walkways, hammered the stage where the night riders performed their grotesque pageants, and the wheeled platform that delivered the doomed men and women to the air. The only thing colored folks hadn't built was the tree. God had made that for the town to bend to evil ends. No wonder the whites wandered the park in the growing darkness, Cora thought, her forehead pressed into the wood. They were ghosts themselves, caught between two worlds, the reality of their crimes and the hereafter denied them for those crimes. Cora was informed of the night riders' rounds by the ripple passing through the park. The evening crowd turned to gawk at a house on the opposite side. A young girl in pigtails led a trio of regulators inside her home. Cora remembered the girl's father had troubled with their porch steps. She hadn't seen him for weeks. The girl clutched her robe to her neck and closed the door behind them. Two night riders, tall and densely proportioned, idled on the porch, smoking their pipes with complacent sloth. The door opened half an hour later, and the team huddled on the sidewalk in a lantern circle, consulting a ledger. They crossed the park, eventually stepping beyond the spy hole's domain. Cora had closed her eyes when their loud rapping on the front door shocked her. They stood directly beneath. The next minutes moved with appalling slowness. Cora huddled in a corner, making herself small behind the final rafter. Sounds furnished details of the action below. Ethel greeted the night riders warmly. Anyone who knew her would be certain she was hiding something. Martin made a quick tour of the attic to make sure nothing was amiss, and then joined everyone downstairs. Martin and Ethel answered their questions quickly as they showed the group around. It was just the two of them. Their daughter lived elsewhere. The night riders searched the kitchen and parlor. The maid, Fiona, had a key, but no one else had access to the house. Up the stairs. They had been visited by no strangers, heard no strange noises, noted nothing out of the ordinary. They searched the two bedrooms. Nothing was missing. There was no cellar. Surely they knew by now that the park houses did not have cellars. Martin had been in the attic that very afternoon and noticed nothing amiss.
Do you mind if we go up?
The voice was gruff and low. Cora assigned it to the shorter night rider, the one with the beard. Their footfalls were loud on the attic stairs. They navigated around the junk. One of them spoke, startling Cora. His head was inches below her. She kept her breath close. The men were sharks, moving their snouts beneath a ship, looking for the food they sensed was close. Only thin planks separated hunter and prey.
We don't go up here that much since the raccoons made a nest, Martin said.
You can smell their mess, the other night rider said.
The regulators departed. Martin skipped his midnight rounds in the attic, scared that they were in the teeth of an elaborate trap. Cora, in her comfortable darkness, patted the sturdy wall. It had kept her safe. They had survived the chamber pot and the night riders. Martin's final bad omen happened that morning. A mob strung up a husband and wife who hid two colored boys in their barn. Their daughter turned them in, jealous of the attention. Despite their youth, the colored boys joined the grisly gallery on the Freedom Trail. One of Ethel's neighbors told her about it in the market, and Ethel fainted dead away, pitching into a row of preserves. Home searches were on the rise. They've been so successful rounding up people that now they have to work hard to meet their quotas, Martin said. Cora offered that perhaps it was good the house had been searched. It would be some time before they returned. More time for the railroad to reach out or for another opportunity to present itself. Martin always fidgeted when Cora raised the idea of initiative. He cradled one of his childhood toys in his hands, a wooden duck. He'd worried the paint from it these last months. "Or it means the roads will be twice as hard to pass," he said. "The boys will be hungry for a souvenir." His face lit up. "Ravening. I think it means very hungry." Cora had been feeling poorly all day. She said goodnight and climbed into her nook. For all the close calls, she was in the same place she had been in for months. Becalmed, between departure and arrival, in transit like the passenger she'd been ever since she ran. Once the wind picked up, she would be moving again, but for now there was only the blank and endless sea. What a world it is, Cora thought, that makes a living prison into your only haven. Was she out of bondage or in its web? How to describe the status of a runaway? Freedom was a thing that shifted as you looked at it, the way a forest is dense with trees up close, but from outside, from the empty meadow, you see its true limits. Being free had nothing to do with chains or how much space you had. On the plantation, she was not free, but she moved unrestricted on its acres, tasting the air and tracing the summer stars. The place was big in its smallness. Here, she was free of her master, but slunk around a warren so tiny she couldn't stand. Cora hadn't left the top floors of the house in months, but her perspective roved widely. North Carolina had its Justice Hill, and she had hers. Looking down over the universe of the park, she saw the town drift where it wanted, washed by sunlight on a stone bench, cooled in the shadows of the hanging tree. But they were prisoners like she was, shackled to fear. Martin and Ethel were terrified of the watchful eyes behind every darkened window. The town huddled together on Friday nights in the hope their numbers warded off the things in the dark, the rising black tribe, the enemy who concocts accusations, the child who undertakes a magnificent revenge for a scolding and brings the house down around them. Better to hide in attics than to confront what lurked behind the faces of neighbors, friends, and family. The park sustained them. The green harbor they preserved as the town extended itself outward, block by block and house by house. Cora thought of her garden back on Randall, the plot she cherished. Now she saw it for the joke it was, a tiny square of dirt that had convinced her she owned something. It was hers like the cotton she seeded, weeded, and picked was hers. Her plot was a shadow of something that lived elsewhere, out of sight. The way poor Michael reciting the Declaration of Independence was an echo of something that existed elsewhere. Now that she had run away and seen a bit of the country, Cora wasn't sure the document described anything real at all. America was a ghost in the darkness, like her. That night, she took ill. Spasms in her belly woke her. In her dizziness, the nook lurched and rocked. She lost the contents of her stomach in the small space and control of her bowels. Heat besieged the tiny room, firing the air and inside her skin. Somehow she made it to morning's light and the lifting of the veil. The park was still there. In the night she had dreamed she was at sea and chained below decks. Next to her was another captive, and another, hundreds of them crying in terror. The ship bucked on swells, dove and slammed into anvils of water. She heard footsteps on the stairs, the sound of the hatch scraping, and she closed her eyes. Cora woke in a white room, a soft mattress cupping her body. The window delivered more than a stingy puncture of sunlight. Park noise was her clock. It was late afternoon. Ethel sat in the corner of her husband's childhood bedroom, her knitting piled in her lap. She stared at Cora. She felt her patient's forehead. "Better," Ethel said. She poured a glass of water, then brought a bowl of beef broth. Ethel's attitude had softened during Cora's delirium. The runaway made so much noise moaning in the night and was so ill when they lowered her from the attic nook that they were obliged to let Fiona go for a few days. Martin had the Venezuelan pox, they told the Irish girl, caught from a tainted bag of feed, and the doctor forbid anyone to enter the house until it had run its course. He'd read about one such quarantine in a magazine, the first excuse that came into his head. They paid the girl her wages for the week. Fiona tucked the money into her purse and asked no more questions. It was Martin's turn to absent himself while Ethel assumed responsibility for their guest, nursing Cora through 2 days of fever and convulsions. The couple had made few friends during their time in the state, making it easier to abstain from the life of town. While Cora twisted in her delirium, Ethel read from the Bible to speed her recuperation. The woman's voice entered her dreams. So stern the night Cora emerged from the mine, it now contained a quality of tenderness. She dreamed the woman kissed her forehead, motherly. Cora listened to her stories, drifting. The ark delivered the worthy, bringing them to the other side of the catastrophe. The wilderness stretched for 40 years before others found their promised land. The afternoon stretched the shadows like taffy, and the park entered its period of diminished popularity as supper approached. Ethel sat in the rocking chair, smiled, and looked through the scripture, trying to find an appropriate section. Now that she was awake and could speak for herself, Cora told her host that the verses were unnecessary. Ethel's mouth formed a line. She closed the book, one thin finger holding her place. "We are all in need of our Savior's grace," Ethel said. "It wouldn't be very Christian of me to let a heathen into my house and not share his word."
"It has been shared," Cora said.
It had been Ethel's childhood Bible that Martin gave to Cora, smudged and stained by her fingers. Ethel quizzed Cora, dubious as to how much their guest could read and understand. To be sure, Cora was not a natural believer, and her education had been terminated sooner than she wished. In the attic, she had struggled with the words, pressed on, doubled back to difficult verses. The contradictions vexed her, even half-understood ones. "I don't get where it says, 'He that stealeth a man and sells him shall be put to death,'" Cora said. "But then later it says, 'Slaves should be submissive to their masters in everything and be well-pleasing.'" Either it was a sin to keep another as property, or it had God's own blessing. But to be well-pleasing in addition? A slaver must have snuck into the printing office and put that in there.
"It means what it says," Ethel said. "It means that a Hebrew may not enslave a Hebrew. But the sons of Ham are not of that tribe. They were cursed with black skin and tails. Where the scripture condemns slavery, it is not speaking of Negro slavery at all."
"I have black skin, but I don't have a tail. As far as I know, I never thought to look," Cora said. "Slavery is a curse, though. That much is true."
Slavery is a sin when whites were put to the yoke, but not the African. "All men are created equal,
unless we decide you are not a man. Under the Georgia sun, Connolly had recited verses while scourging field hands for infractions.
Niggers, obey your earthly masters in everything, and do it not only when their eye is on you and to win their favor, but with sincerity of heart and reverence for the Lord.
The slash of the cat o' nine tails punctuating every syllable, and a wail from the victim. Cora remembered other passages on slavery in the Good Book and shared them with her host. Ethel said she didn't wake up that morning to get into a theological argument. Cora enjoyed the woman's company and frowned when she left. For her part, Cora blamed the people who wrote it down. People always got things wrong, on purpose as much as by accident. The next morning, Cora asked for the almanacs. They were obsolete, last year's weather, but Cora adored the old almanacs for containing the entire world. They didn't need people to say what they meant. The tables and facts couldn't be shaped into what they were not. The vignettes and parodies between the lunar tables and weather reports about cranky old widows and simple darkies confused her as much as the moral lessons in the Holy Book. Both described human behavior beyond her ken. What did she know or need to know of fancy wedding manners or moving a herd of lambs through the desert? One day she might use the almanac's instructions, at least. Odes to the atmosphere, odes to the cocoa tree of the South Sea Islands. She hadn't heard of odes or atmospheres before, but as she worked through the pages, these creatures took up residence in her mind. Should she ever own boots, she now knew the trick of tallow and wax that extended their use. If one of her chickens got the snuffles one day, rubbing asafoetida in butter on their nostrils would set them straight. Martin's father had needed the almanacs to plan for the full moon. The books held prayers for runaways. The moon grew fat and thin. There were solstices, first frosts, and spring rains. All these things proceeded without the interference of men. She tried to imagine what the tide looked like, coming in and going out, nipping at the sand like a little dog, heedless of people and their machinations. Her strength returned. On her own, she couldn't understand all the words. Cora asked Ethel, "Can you read some to me?" Ethel growled, but she opened an almanac where the spine broke and, in compromise with herself, used the same cadences she used for the Bible. Transplanting the evergreens. It seems not very material whether evergreen trees are transplanted in April, May, or June. When Friday arrived, Cora was much improved. Fiona was set to come back on Monday. They agreed that in the morning, Cora should return to the Nook. Martin and Ethel would invite a neighbor or two for cake to dispel any gossip or speculation. Martin practiced a wan demeanor, perhaps even host someone for the Friday festival. Their porch had a perfect view. That evening, Ethel let Cora stay in the extra bedroom, provided she kept the room dark and stayed away from the window. Cora had no intention of watching the weekly spectacle, but looked forward to one last stretch in the bed. In the end, Martin and Ethel thought better of inviting people over, so the only guests were the uninvited ones that stepped out of the crowd at the start of the coon show. The regulators wanted to search the house. The performance stopped, the town buzzing at the commotion at the side of the park. Ethel tried to stall the night riders. They pushed past her and Martin. Cora started for the stairs, but they complained reliably, warning her so often these last few months that she knew she wouldn't be able to make it. She crawled under Martin's old bed, and that's where they found her, snatching her ankles like irons and dragging her out. They tossed her down the stairs.
She jammed her shoulder into the banister at the bottom. Her ears rang. She laid eyes on Martin and Ethel's porch for the first time. It was the stage for her capture. A second bandstand for the town's amusement as she lay on the planks at the feet of four regulators in their white and black uniforms. Another four restrained Martin and Ethel. One more man stood on the porch, dressed in a worsted plaid vest and gray trousers. He was one of the tallest men Cora had ever seen, solidly built, with an arresting gaze. He surveyed the scene and smiled at a private joke. The town filled the sidewalk and the street, jostling each other for a view of this new entertainment. A young red-headed girl pushed through.
"Venezuelan pox! I told you they had someone up there!"
So here was Fiona, finally. Cora propped herself up for a look at the girl she knew so well but had never seen.
"You'll get your reward," the night rider with the beard said. He'd been to the house on the previous search.
"You say, you lummox," Fiona said. "You said you checked the attic last time, but you didn't, did you?"
She turned to the town to establish witnesses for her claim.
"You all see? It's my reward. All that food missing."
Fiona kicked Cora lightly with her foot.
"She'd make a big roast and then the next day it was gone. Who was eating all that food? Always looking up at the ceiling. What were they looking at?"
She was so young, Cora thought. Her face was a round and freckled apple, but there was hardness in her eyes. It was difficult to believe the grunts and cusses she'd heard over the months had come out of that little mouth, but the eyes were proof enough.
"We treated you nice," Martin said.
"You have an awful queer way, both of you," Fiona said, "and you deserve whatever you get."
The town had seen justice served too many times to count, but the rendering of the verdict was a new experience. It made them uneasy. Were they a jury now, in addition to the gallery? They looked at each other for cues. An old-timer made his hand into a cone and hollered nonsense through it. A half-eaten apple hit Cora's stomach. On the bandstand, the coon show players stood with their disheveled hats in their hands, deflated. Jameson appeared, rubbing his forehead with a red handkerchief. Cora had not seen him since the first night, but she had heard every speech of the Friday night finales, every joke and grandiose claim, the appeals to race and statehood, and then the order to kill the sacrifice. The interruption in the proceedings confounding him. Absent its usual bluster, Jameson's voice squeaked.
"This is something," he said. "Aren't you Donald's son?"
Martin nodded, his soft body quivering with quiet sobs.
"I know your daddy would be ashamed," Jameson said.
"I had no idea what he was up to," Ethel said.
She tugged against the night riders who gripped her tight.
"He did it himself. I didn't know anything."
Martin looked away. From the people on the porch, from the town. He turned his face north toward Virginia, where he had been free of his hometown for a time. Jameson gestured and the night riders pulled Martin and Ethel to the park. The planter looked Cora over.
"A nice treat," Jameson said. Their scheduled victim was in the wings somewhere. "Should we do both?"
The tall man said,
"This one is mine. I've made it clear."
Jameson's expression curdled. He was not accustomed to ignorance of his status. He asked for the stranger's name.
"Ridgeway," the man said. "Slave catcher. I go here, I go there. I've been after this one for a long time. Your judge knows all about me." "You can't just come in here muscling about,"
Jameson was aware that his usual audience, milling outside the property, observed him with undefined expectations. At the new tremor in his words, two Knight Riders, young bucks both, stepped forward to crowd Ridgway. Ridgway exhibited no bother over the display.
You all have your local customs going on here. I get that. Having your fun.
He pronounced fun like a temperance preacher.
But it doesn't belong to you. The fugitive slave law says I have a right to return this property to its owner. That's what I aim to do.
Cora whimpered and felt her head. She was dizzy, like she'd been after Terrence struck her. This man was going to return her to him. The Knight Rider who threw Cora down the stairs cleared his throat. He explained to Jameson that the slave catcher had led them to the house. The man had visited Judge Tennyson that afternoon and made an official request, although the judge had been enjoying his customary Friday whiskey and might not remember. No one was keen on executing the raid during the festival, but Ridgway had insisted. Ridgway spat tobacco juice on the sidewalk at the feet of some onlookers.
You can keep the reward, he told Fiona.
He bent slightly and lifted Cora by her arm.
You don't have to be afraid, Cora. You're going home.
A little colored boy, about 10 years old, drove a wagon up the street through the crowd, shouting at the two horses. On any other occasion, the sight of him in his tailored black suit and stovepipe hat would have been a cause of bewilderment. After the dramatic capture of the sympathizers and the runaway, his appearance nudged the knight into the realm of the fantastical. More than one person thought what had just transpired was a new wrinkle in the Friday entertainment, a performance arranged to counter the monotony of the weekly skits and lynchings, which, to be honest, had grown predictable. At the foot of the porch, Fiona held forth to a group of girls from Irish Town.
A girl's got to look after her interests if she's going to get ahead in this country, she explained.
Ridgway rode with another man in addition to the boy, a tall white man with long brown hair and a necklace of human ears around his neck. His associate shackled Cora's ankles and then ran the chains through a ring in the floor of the wagon. She arranged herself on the bench, her head pulsing in agony with every heartbeat. As they pulled away, she saw Martin and Ethel. They had been tied to the hanging tree. They sobbed and heaved at their bonds. Mayor ran in mad circles at their feet. A blonde girl picked up a rock and threw it at Ethel, hitting her in the face. A segment of the town laughed at Ethel's piteous shrieks. Two more children picked up rocks and threw them at the couple. Mayor yipped and jumped as more people bent to the ground. They raised their arms. The town moved in. And then Cora couldn't see them anymore. Ethel. Ever since she saw a woodcut of a missionary surrounded by jungle natives, Ethel thought it would be spiritually fulfilling to serve the Lord in dark Africa, delivering savages to the light. She dreamed of the ship that would take her, a magnificent schooner with sails like angel wings cutting across the violent sea. The perilous journey into the interior, up rivers, wending mountain passes, and the dangers escaped. Lions, serpents, man-killing plants, duplicitous guides. And then the village, where the natives receive her as an emissary of the Lord, an instrument of civilization. In gratitude, the niggers lift her to the sky, praising her name, Ethel, Ethel. She was 8 years old. Her father's newspapers contained tales of explorers, unknown lands, pygmy peoples. The nearest she could get to the image in the newspaper was playing missionary and native with Jasmine. Jasmine was like a sister to her.
The game never lasted long before they switched to husband and wife, practicing kisses and arguments in the cellar of Ethel's house. Given the color of their skins, there was never any doubt over their roles in either game. Ethel's habit of rubbing soot onto her face notwithstanding, her face blackened, she practiced expressions of amazement and wonder in front of the mirror so she'd know what to expect when she met her heathens. Jasmine lived in the upstairs room with her mother, Felice. The Delaney family owned Felice's mother, and when little Edgar Delaney turned 10, he received Felice as a present. Now that he was a man, Edgar recognized that Felice was a miracle, tending to the affairs of his house as if she were born to it. He recounted her darky wisdom as a matter of routine, sharing her parables about human nature with guests whenever she disappeared into the kitchen so that when she returned, their faces glowed with affection and jealousy. He gave her passes to visit the Parker plantation every New Year's Day feast. Felice's sister was a washwoman there. Jasmine was born 9 months after one such visit, and now the Delaneys owned 2 slaves. Ethel thought that a slave was someone who lived in your house like family, but was not family. Her father explained the origin of the Negro to disabuse her of this colorful idea. Some maintained that the Negro was the remnant of a race of giants who had ruled the earth in an ancient time. But Edgar Delaney knew they were descendants of cursed Black Ham, who had survived the flood by clinging to the peaks of a mountain in Africa. Ethel thought that if they were cursed, they required Christian guidance all the more. On her 8th birthday, Ethel's father forbid her to play with Jasmine so as not to pervert the natural state of relations between the races. Ethel did not make friends easily, even then. She sobbed and stomped for days. Jasmine was more adaptable. Jasmine assumed simple duties around the household and took over her mother's position when Felice's heart seized and she fell mute and paralyzed. Felice lingered for months, her mouth open and pink, eyes foggy, until Ethel's father had her removed. Ethel observed no disturbances in her old playmate's face when they loaded her mother into the cart. By then, the two did not speak outside of household matters. The house had been built 50 years before, and the stairs creaked. A whisper in one room carried into the next two. Most nights after supper and prayers, Ethel heard her father going up the crooked stairs, guided by the bobbing light of the candle. Sometimes she sneaked to her bedroom door and caught a glimpse of his white bedclothes disappearing around the corner.
"Where are you going, Father?"
she asked one night. Felice had been gone 2 years. Jasmine was 14.
"Going upstairs," he said,
and both experienced a strange relief now that they had a term for his nocturnal visits. He was going upstairs. Where else did the stairs lead? Her father had given one explanation for the separation of the races in fratricidal punishment. His nighttime trips elaborated on the arrangement. Whites lived downstairs, and blacks lived upstairs, and to bridge that separation was to heal a biblical wound. Her mother held a low opinion about her husband going upstairs, but was not without resources. When their family sold Jasmine to the coppersmith on the other side of town, Ethel knew it was her mother's doing. There was no more going upstairs when the new slave took residence. Nancy was a grandmother, slow in her steps and half blind. Now it was her wheezing that penetrated the walls, not footsteps and squeals. The house had not been so clean and orderly since Felice. Jasmine had been efficient but distracted. Jasmine's new home was across the way in Colored Town. Everyone whispered that the child had his father's eyes. One day over lunch, Ethel announced that when she was old enough, She intended to spread the Christian word to African primitives. Her parents scoffed. It was not something that good young women from Virginia did. If you want to help savages, her father said, teach school. The brain of a 5-year-old is more savage and unruly than the oldest jungle darky, he said. Her course was set. Ethel filled in for the regular teacher when she was under the weather. Little white children were primitive in their own way, chirping and undeveloped, but it wasn't the same. Her thoughts of the jungle and a ring of dark admirers remained in her private preserve. Resentment was the hinge of her personality. The young women in her circle comported themselves in a foreign ritual, undecipherable. She had little use for boys, and later, men. When Martin appeared, introduced by one of her cousins who worked at the shipping company, she had tired of the gossip and long relinquished an interest in happiness. A panting badger, Martin wore her down. The game of husband and wife was even less fun than she supposed. Jane, at least, turned out to be an unexpected mercy. A tidy bouquet in her arms, even if conception proved yet another humiliation. Over the years, life on Orchard Street passed with a tedium that eventually congealed into comfort. She pretended not to see Jasmine when they passed on the street, especially when her former playmate was in the company of her son. His face was a dark mirror. Then Martin was summoned to North Carolina. He arranged Donald's funeral on the hottest day of the year. They thought she fainted from sadness when it was just the barbaric humidity. Once they got a taker for the feed shop, they were done, he assured her. The place was backward. If it wasn't the heat, it was the flies. If not the mice, then the people. At least in Virginia, lynch mobs maintained a pretext of spontaneity. They didn't string up people practically on your front lawn the same time every week, like church. North Carolina was to be a brief interlude, or so she thought, until she came across the nigger in her kitchen. George had dropped out of the attic for some food, the lone slave Martin helped before the girl arrived. It was a week before the race laws went into effect and violence against the colored population was on the rise in rehearsal. A note on their doorstep had directed Martin to the mica mine, he told her. George waited for him, hungry and irritated. The tobacco picker thumped around the attic for a week before a railroad agent took him on the next leg, boxing him up in a crate and shoving the thing through the front door. Ethel was livid, then despairing. George acted as Donald's executor, illuminating Martin's secret inheritance. He'd lost 3 fingers on his hand, cutting cane. Slavery as a moral issue never interested Ethel. If God had not meant for Africans to be enslaved, they wouldn't be in chains. She did, however, have firm ideas about not getting killed for other people's high-minded ideas. She and Martin argued over the Underground Railroad as they hadn't argued in a long time, and that was before the murderous fine print of the race laws manifested itself. Through Cora, that termite in the attic, Donald reached from beyond the grave to punish her for her joke those many years before. When their families met for the first time, Ethel made a remark about Donald's simple country suit. She was trying to call attention to the two families' different ideas of proper attire, to get it out of the way, so they could all enjoy the meal Ethel had spent so much time planning. But Donald had never forgiven her, she told Martin. She was sure of it. And now they were going to swing from the branches of the tree right outside their front door. When Martin went upstairs to help the girl, it was not in the same way her father had gone upstairs. But both men came down transformed. They reached across the biblical rift for a selfish purpose. If they could, why not her?
Everything had been denied Ethel her whole life. To mission, to help, to give love in the way she wanted. When the girl got sick, the moment Ethel awaited for so long had finally arrived. In the end, she had not gone to Africa. Africa had come to her. Ethel went upstairs, as her father had done, to confront the stranger who lived in her house as family. The girl lay on the sheets, curved like a primeval river. She cleaned the girl, washing her filth from her. She kissed the girl on her forehead and neck in her restless slumber, with two kinds of feeling mixed up in those kisses. She gave her the holy word. A savage to call her own. At last. Tennessee. $25 reward. Ran away from the subscriber on the 6th of February last. His Negro girl, Peggy. She is about 16 years of age and is a bright mulatto, about the ordinary height, with straight hair and tolerable good features. She has a ragged scar on her neck occasioned by a burn. She will no doubt attempt to pass for a free girl, and it is likely she has obtained a free pass. She has a down look when spoken to, and not remarkably intelligent. She speaks quick with a shrill voice. John Dark, Chatham County, May 17.
Jesus, carry me home. Home to that land.
Jasper wouldn't stop singing. Ridgway shouted from the head of their little caravan for him to shut his mouth, and sometimes they halted so Bozeman could climb into the wagon and clout the runaway on the head. Jasper sucked the scars on his fingers for a short interval, then resumed his crooning, quietly at first, so that only Cora could hear. But soon he'd be singing again, to his lost family, to his God, to everyone they passed on the trail. He'd have to be disciplined again. Cora recognized some of the hymns. She suspected he made up many of them. The rhymes were crooked. She wouldn't have minded it so much if Jasper had a better voice, but Jesus had not blessed him in that department, or with looks. He had a lopsided frog face and oddly thin arms for a field hand. Or with luck, luck least of all. He and Cora had that in common. They picked up Jasper 3 days out of North Carolina. Jasper was a delivery. He absconded from the Florida cane fields and made it to Tennessee before a tinker caught him stealing food from his pantry. After a few weeks, the deputy located his owner, but the tinker had no means of transport. Ridgway and Bozeman were drinking in a tavern around the corner from the jail while little Homer waited with Cora and the wagon. The town clerk approached the famous slave catcher, brokered an arrangement, and Ridgway now had the nigger chained in the wagon. He hadn't reckoned the man for a songbird. The rain tapped on the canopy. Cora enjoyed the breeze and then felt ashamed for enjoying something. They stopped to eat when the rain let up. Bozeman slapped Jasper, chuckled, and unchained the two fugitives from the wagon floor. He offered his customary vulgar promise as he knelt before Cora, sniffing. Jasper's and Cora's wrists and ankles remained manacled. It was the longest she had ever been in chains. Crows glided over. The world was scorched and harrowed as far as they could see. A sea of ash and char from the flat plains of the fields up to the hills and mountains. Black trees tilted, stunted black arms pointing as if to a distant place untouched by flame. They rode past the blackened bones of houses and barns without number, chimneys sticking up like grave markers, the husked stone walls of ravaged mills and granaries. Scorched fences marked where cattle had grazed. It was not possible the animals survived. After 2 days of riding through it, they were covered in black grime.
Ridgway said it made him feel at home, the blacksmith's son. This is what Cora saw. Nowhere to hide. No refuge between those black stalks, even if she weren't fettered. Even if she had an opportunity. An old white man in a gray coat trotted by on a dun horse. Like the other travelers they passed on the black road, he slowed in curiosity. Two adult slaves were common enough, but the colored boy in the black suit driving the wagon and his queer smile discomfited strangers. The younger white man with the red derby wore a necklace adorned with pieces of shriveled leather. When they figured out these were human ears, he bared a line of intermittent teeth, browned by tobacco. The older white man in command discouraged all conversation with his glowering. The traveler moved on, around the bend where the road limped between the denuded hills. Homer unfolded a moth-eaten quilt for them to sit on and distributed their portions on tin plates. The slave catcher allowed his prisoners an equal share of the food, a custom dating to his earliest days in the job. It reduced complaints and he billed the client. At the edge of the blackened field, they ate the salt pork and the beans Bozeman had prepared, the dry flies screeching in waves. Rain agitated the smell of the fire, making the air bitter. Smoke flavored every bite of food, each sip of water. Jasper sang, "Jump up," the Redeemer said. Jump up if you want to see his face." "Hallelujah," Bozeman shouted. "Fat little Jesus baby." His words echoed and he did a dance, splashing dark water. "He's not eating," Cora said. Jasper had foregone the last few meals, screwing his mouth shut and crossing his arms.
"Then it doesn't eat," Ridgway said.
He waited for her to say something, having grown used to her chirping at his remarks. They were on to each other. She kept silent to interrupt their pattern. Homer scampered over and gobbled down Jasper's portion. He sensed Cora staring at him and grinned without looking up. The driver of the wagon was an odd little imp, 10 years old, Chester's age, but imbued with the melancholy grace of an elderly house slave, the sum of practiced gestures. He was fastidious about his fine black suit and stovepipe hat, extracting lint from the fabric and glaring at it as if it were a poisoned spider before flicking it. Homer rarely spoke apart from his hectoring of the horses. Of racial affinity or sympathy, he gave no indication. Cora and Jasper might as well have been invisible most of the time, smaller than lint. Homer's duties encompassed driving the team, sundry maintenance, and what Ridgway termed bookkeeping. Homer maintained the business accounts and recorded Ridgway's stories in a small notebook he kept in his coat pocket. What made this or that utterance from the slave catcher worthy of inclusion, Cora could not discern. The boy preserved worldly truism and matter-of-fact observations about the weather with equal zeal. Prompted by Cora one night, Ridgway maintained that he'd never owned a slave in his life, save for the 14 hours Homer was his property. "Why not?" she asked.
"What for?" he said.
Ridgway was riding through the outskirts of Atlanta. He'd just delivered a husband and wife to their owner, all the way from New York, when he came upon a butcher trying to square a gambling debt. His wife's family had given them the boy's mother as a wedding gift. The butcher had sold her during his previous stretch of bad luck. Now it was the boy's turn. He painted a crude sign to hang around the boy's neck, advertising the offer. The boy's strange sensibility moved Ridgway. Homer's shining eyes, set in his round, pudgy face, were at once feral and serene. A kindred spirit. Ridgway bought him for $5 and drew up emancipation papers the next day. Homer remained at his side despite Ridgway's half-hearted attempts to shoo him away. The butcher had held no strong opinions on the subject of colored education and had permitted the boy to study with the children of some free men. Out of boredom, Ridgway helped him with his letters. Homer pretended he was of Italian extraction when it suited him and let his questioners sit with their bewilderment. His unconventional attire evolved over time. His disposition remained unchanged.
If he's free, why don't he go?
Where? Ridgway asked. He's seen enough to know a black boy has no future, free papers or no. Not in this country. Some disreputable character would snatch him and put him on the block lickety-split. With me, he can learn about the world. Find purpose.
Each night, with meticulous care, Homer opened his satchel and removed a set of manacles. He locked himself to the driver's seat, put the key in his pocket, and closed his eyes. Ridgway caught Cora looking.
He says it's the only way he can sleep.
Homer snored like a rich old man every night. Bozeman, for his part, had been riding with Ridgway for 3 years. He was a rambler out of South Carolina and found his way to slave catching after a hard scrabble sequence. Dockhand, collection agent, gravedigger. Bozeman was not the most intelligent fellow, but had a knack for anticipating Ridgway's wishes in a manner equal parts indispensable and eerie. Ridgway's gang numbered 5 when Bozeman joined, but his employees drifted off one by one. The reason was not immediately clear to Cora. The previous owner of the ear necklace had been an Indian named Strong. Strong had promoted himself as a tracker, but the only creature he sniffed out reliably was whiskey. Bozeman won the accessory in a wrestling contest, and when Strong disputed the terms of their match, Bozeman clobbered the red man with a shovel. Strong lost his hearing and ditched the gang to work in a tannery in Canada, or so the rumor went. Even though the ears were dried and shriveled, they drew flies when it was hot. Bozeman loved his souvenir, however, and the revulsion on a new client's face was too delectable. The flies hadn't harassed the Indian when he owned it, as Ridgway reminded him from time to time. Bozeman stared at the hills between bites and had an uncharacteristically wistful air. He walked off to urinate, and when he came back, said,
"My daddy passed through here, I think."
He said it was forest then.
When he came back, it had all been cleared by settlers. "Now it's doubly cleared," Ridgway responded. "It's true what you say. This road was a horse path. Next time you need to make a road, Bozeman, make sure you have 10,000 starving Cherokee on hand to clear it for you. Saves time."
"Where did they go?" Cora asked. After her nights with Martin, she had a sense of when white men were on the brink of a story. It gave her time to consider her options. Ridgway was an ardent reader of gazettes. The fugitive bulletins made them a requirement in his line of work. Homer maintained a thorough collection, and current affairs generally upheld his theories about society and the human animal. The type of individuals in his employ had made him accustomed to explaining the most elementary facts and history. He could hardly expect a slave girl to know the significance of their environs. They sat on what was once Cherokee land, he said, the land of their red fathers, until the president decided otherwise and ordered them removed. Settlers needed the land, and if the Indians hadn't learned by then that the white man's treaties were entirely worthless, Ridgway said, they deserved what they got. Some of his friends had been with the army at that time. They rounded up the Indians in camps, the women and children and whatever they could carry on their backs, and marched them west of the Mississippi. The trail of tears and death, as one Cherokee sage put it later, not without cause, not without that Indian flair for rhetoric. Disease and malnutrition, not to mention the biting winter that year, which Ridgway himself remembered without fondness, claimed thousands. When they got to Oklahoma, there were still more white people waiting for them, squatting on the land the Indians had been promised in the latest worthless treaty. Slow learners, the bunch. But here they were on this road today. The trip to Missouri was much more comfortable than it had been previously, tamped by little red feet.
"Progress," Ridgway said. "My cousin got lucky and won some Indian land in the lottery in the north part of Tennessee. Grows corn."
Cora cocked her head at the desolation. "Lucky," she said. On their way in, Ridgway told them that a lightning strike must have started the fire. The smoke filled the sky for hundreds of miles, tinting the sunset into gorgeous contusions of crimson and purple. This was Tennessee announcing itself. Fantastic beasts twisting in a volcano. For the first time, she crossed into another state without using the Underground Railroad. The tunnels had protected her. The station master Lumley had said that each state was a state of possibility with its own customs. The red sky made her dread the rules of this next territory. As they rode toward the smoke, the sunsets inspired Jasper to share a suite of hymns whose central theme was the wrath of God and the mortifications awaiting the wicked. Bozeman made frequent trips to the wagon. The town at